From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the second day of July 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the agricultural futures markets with Mike Zuzulo. He's at Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Lafayette, Indiana. The cash grain market will be covered by Bruce Bostard at the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. And the agricultural weather forecast, well, the weather forecast for July 4th weekend, how about that, will be taken up by James Angel. Jim's at the Illinois State Water Survey, where he serves as the state climatologist. In the second half hour of our program today, we'll talk with Bruce Blanton of USDA about the latest agricultural transportation study. And we'll hear our weekly In My Backyard segment from Lisa Braltz. And it all happens on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
This stock and commodity report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal, providing clients with the latest market information based on research by ADM Investor Services and other independent sources. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
In Chicago on a Friday afternoon, futures finished like this. The nearby July soft red at 487.75 from the wheat pit, 3.75 higher. September at 503, up 3.25, and December at 529, up 4.75. Hard red in Kansas City at 507.25, up 6.25. Back in Chicago from the corn pit, lead option July down a penny and a half at $3.64. September corn 372.5, 3/4 lower. The December harvest month at 384.5. Unchanged. March contract 396.5 a bushel, down a half, and the May corn of next year at 404.25, down 0.5 cent. So July soybeans 962.75, up 9.25. August at 944.5, 7.5 higher. September at 916.25, 3/4 higher, and November beans at 905.75, up 0.25. January contract at 914.75, finished down 0.25. July bean meal at 294.90, up 3.40. The July soybean oil at 36.01, 14 higher. August live cattle futures 89.47.5, down 47.5. October's at 90.92.5, down 37.5 cents. August feeders at 112.67.5, up 7.5 cents. September feeder cattle at 112.75, a dime higher for the day. And July lean hog futures $78.20, down $1.10. The August contract at $80.05, down $1.80. That all, of course, from the CME Group in Chicago. You are listening to the Closing Market Report from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures August contract $72.18 a barrel, down 77 cents. Ethanol at $1.54.05. That's $1.54.5, a penny higher on the day. Natural gas at $4.66.09, down 18.5 cents. And the heating oil at $1.91.06, down 2.2 cents for the day. Gold futures at $1,207.40, $1.10 higher. The Dow at 96.53, down about 79 points. And the dollar down 0.28 at 84.43 on the afternoon. The CRB index at 254.51 is down 170 for the day. Here's what the weather forecast looks like from Drew Lerner. He says dry weather will occur into Saturday, with Ohio, Indiana, and Kentucky staying dry right on through Sunday, July the 4th. Temperatures will trend a bit warmer after today. Highs today still in the upper 70s and the low 80s, so very nice outside this afternoon. Lows tonight will be in the 50s with a few upper 40s in Ohio. A warming trend this weekend, and then the next week will produce daily high temperatures back into the 80s, a few low 90s. Showers should push into Iowa, northwestern Illinois late Saturday, more likely on Sunday. Scattered showers and thunderstorms will overspread most of the Midwest during the early to mid part of next week. Strong showers, rather slow-moving thunderstorms next week could produce locally heavy rainfall. Some relief to the dry, biased areas for Kansas to Kentucky. Southern Illinois and southwestern Indiana is possible by mid to late next week. We'll take a more complete look at the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour, and we talk with Jim Angel.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
It is a Friday afternoon. This is the Closing Market Report. On the phone line with us to take a look at the agricultural futures markets, Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Lafayette, Indiana. Good afternoon to you, Mike.
Good afternoon, Todd.
It feels like a better Friday than it did last week, I think.
You know, it really does feel like Independence Weekend, doesn't it? It feels like we have something to light fireworks off, doesn't it?
Well, when you look at the weekly trade, it wasn't too terribly bad. We had a USDA report that popped things up on earlier in the week, 23.5 cents the gain week over week in the July corn, December up 24. It finished at 384.5. That's not too bad a rally, I would think.
No, in fact, one of the news wires pointed out that the largest two-day rise in corn, this 12% jump the last 2 days, is the best we've seen since 1988. So I thought that was pretty remarkable as well.
Yeah, the only thing I didn't like about that sentence was 1988.
Yeah, I don't think we have to worry about a drought for the corn at this point if those next week weather forecasts hold. And I think that certainly came into the trade bias today, Todd, especially the wheat bias. It seemed like Kansas City futures started to pick up a little bit more steam and wanted to seemingly take over as kind of the leader again in the wheat pits. We've had soft red wheat in the cash market hitting, in some areas in the cash markets, hitting six-month highs because we've had pretty disappointing yields. We've had some quality issues, and most importantly, in the eastern Corn Belt, you and I have talked about this quite a bit, we've had a lot of vomitoxin issues. A couple clients over in Ohio have told me this week that elevators are physically not taking wheat in certain locations now. It's the first time that I had ever heard that happening in that big of a wheat belt. These are elevators that aren't too far from Toledo, so pretty substantial issues. The soft red wheat has taken on the leadership here in the last month, month and a half, because of the cash market and that convergence with that new way of factoring in the delivery price and how much the bushels were worth in consecutive months, but now the hard red started to come on. I think that's probably because we're looking at only about 55% of Kansas harvested as of Monday with these remnants of Alex coming in starting even this weekend. I think it's going to be hard to get that last 20 to 30% of the wheat out. So the hard red futures seem to be taking on a little bit more strength as well.
Yeah, if I've learned anything from talking to you over the years is that you really like it when wheat starts to lead the grains higher. Is that the case this time around?
Oh, more than ever, yeah, because the wheat numbers, you know, we had 30 million bushels more on the stocks number for 09 than the trade was expecting. We had 45 million more in the 2010 acreage numbers because USDA put another 500,000 acreage increase into the numbers on Wednesday morning. And so when I saw the wheat actually leading the corn higher yesterday, I believe it was, I thought this really has a good look to it. And then I started to see where over in Europe and Western Australia, there's quite a few problems going on. It's starting to surface. It's starting to get the market's attention. You know, we've talked about it before, how things kind of get pushed into the closet, whether they're bearish or bullish, whatever's opposite the trade mindset kind of gets pushed into the closet. But eventually, it's kind of like a kid's closet. And eventually, that closet door comes crashing open and all that stuff comes out. Hot weather in France in particular is damaging the barley yields from the early reports. Yields down as much as 10%. Paris wheat futures have been rallying on that, thinking that maybe the barley yields are going to give us an indication of what the wheat yields are like. And as far as the Southern Plains harvest, the clients I have in Texas have not been happy with their harvested, their bushels so far. They're about 10 bushels underneath what they've wanted. Even clients in Kansas have been mixed in their assessment. And the fact that we went from 10% harvested last week to 55% in Kansas in 1 week makes me wonder whether the yields are not there because we got through it so quick.
Interesting stuff. And it's probably important to stop and note here that really, while we talk about South America and Argentina as a wheat export, they're on the flip side of the season, so they wouldn't have any wheat at this point to harvest. And that the bulk of the wheat is actually produced in the Northern Hemisphere all
right
across the globe.
And right. You've also got the issue where the Europeans and the Black Sea have been the ones that have been taking most of the business away from us.
So what does it mean to the corn market?
Well, I was expecting that we would pull back here today. I really thought that we may even pull back and hit that 378 50-day moving average because yesterday what was so interesting to me was that we saw the dollar correct substantially. I mean, several percentage points in the last couple 3 days in a correction in the dollar when the technicals actually look like it should have been a buy, but the fundamentals are overpowering. So translating that back to the corn trade and the wheat trade and the bean trade, as the dollar was breaking through its 50-day moving average, the corn and the wheat were breaking above their 50-day moving averages for the first time since late spring. So to me, I thought maybe we'd get the corn to pull back here on a continued dry weather pattern and just a three-day holiday. Longs want to take some profit after this terrific run up. But wheat and beans came in and salvaged the day and allowed the wheat, allowed the corn to stay above that 380 level and stay almost right around that 385 level. So I think all in all, this is a very good trade today, especially in light of another big down day in the equities and another big down day in the crude oil markets.
Were you disappointed that it wasn't able to take out last week's high and put in an outside up week?
Not right now. I think that because the July 9th report is right around the corner, I would be much happier that it happens next week going into that July 9th USDA report. And the reason I say that, Todd, is because we were coming off of levels that I felt like we were, you know, 20, 30, 40 cents too cheap to begin with, because the trade was already pricing in a 167, 169 yield for 2010. And quite frankly, they had forgotten the problems we had with test weights and the Dakotas and what we had with in terms of quality issues back in the 09 corn crop. So I felt like they were just catching up this week with what the past numbers were supposed to be anyway. Now we'll look to the future. And I kind of got that feeling from the people I talked to in Chicago. They're really looking at the weather next week. They're going to really look at Tuesday afternoon's crop conditions report. If we see more degradation by in good to excellent for corn and beans, and we throw another 2 to 3 inches on top of the rain gauge next week because of the remnants of Alex coming through, I think that will cause the trade to want to take out last week's highs or this current week's highs and probably push us up right underneath that $4 level.
Historically, the July report not worth a lot to the marketplace, but this time around we've got some acreage figures that you have to figure back into the WASD numbers, I suppose. And there is a crop production report, but that won't be for corn and beans.
No, and you know, it's an interesting statistic. You bring up a huge point because we're changing quarters. We're beginning the third quarter, and I found out that the number of S&P stocks right now that are above the 50-day moving average is only 4% right now. And so I think there may be a real potential where money comes out of bonds because the longer-term bond charts that have, you know, the bonds have been such a safe haven. Now the dollar is corrected, and it's no longer a safe haven. Maybe it's a leading indicator to next week the bonds end up not being a safe haven. Money comes back out of bonds, goes back into stocks and commodities in terms of just value-level investing, and that's why I think next week is super important.
And anything else to add before I let you go for the day?
I guess the only other thing I would say to you is the July NOV bean spread really performed well today. We had that thing move up to almost 60 cents. That takes us back up to the March 30th, you know, when the grain stocks and acreage report, the previous one, was out. We have that back up to that price level. It's very, very strong going into next week as far as supporting the new crop November futures. So I like the idea of trying to settle back and go up to that next level higher. Key support levels for the beans are going to be that 894 level in November, 378 in Dees corn.
Thanks so much, Mike.
Hey, happy 4th of July, sir.
Hey, you too. Mike Zuzulo is with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Lafayette, Indiana. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report. Happens each and every Friday afternoon.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baesdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Well, have you visited yet our website? If not, please do. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. You can hear all of our ag programming from the pre-opening market report to the closing market report each and every day off the website. Sign up to have it delivered to your computer automatically as a podcast and for our free weekend newsletter. It's a good one. Just hit subscribe over on the right-hand side of the page. Can't get to the website, can't hear us on the radio. How about dialing this number, 217-333-3434. We update at 10:15 and 3:15 with either the opening or the closing market numbers and a bit of analysis. Now here's Dave with the news.
In agricultural news, USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack urged Congress yesterday to reauthorize the child nutrition programs this year with a big increase in spending. Vilsack says a cut might be possible in the popular Environmental Quality Incentives Program and other USDA programs to pay for it. In testimony before the House Education and Labor Committee, Vilsack said, quote, "If we don't do it this year, it is not going to get any easier." Vilsack also seemed to appeal to the committee's political instincts, saying that there are many pieces of legislation the public does not understand, but that, quote, "moms and dads understand precisely what this bill is about." The committee is considering a bill to make it easier for low-income children to qualify for free meals and to improve the quality of the meals. Both steps would cost more money, and the bill provides an additional $8 billion for school meal programs over 10 years. The Senate Agriculture Committee has already approved a similar bill, but it would only increase spending by $4.5 billion. A sudden heat wave in much of West Europe in the past week has raised concerns that the wheat crop could be damaged at a critical stage just before harvest starts. The heat wave in France, the EU's largest wheat producer, raises the danger of lower yields in areas where plant development is already running late. The hot weather in France in the past week is forecast to continue in the week ahead. In Germany, Europe's second largest wheat producer, there is also concern that the heat would push wheat into early ripeness. Laws intended to clamp down on the use of certain derivatives to avoid taxes may reduce trading in swaps backed by equities and potentially reduce demand from overseas investors for U.S. shares. The Internal Revenue Service has begun auditing banks to determine whether institutions have enabled foreign holders of U.S. stocks to use swaps to avoid paying taxes on the stock holdings. U.S. banks will need to pay the taxes if they are found to have assisted investors to enter into the swaps for the purpose of avoiding tax. China said today its economy rebounded even more strongly from the global slump last year than previously thought, raising its official growth estimate from 8.7% to 9.1%. The latest figure showed the strength of China's stimulus-fueled rebound. Analysts expect China's growth to slow slightly this year as the effect of its $586 billion stimulus wears off. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of this program and of Commodity Week. That second program, Commodity Week, will be posted to our website at willag.org by about 6 p.m. this evening. Our guests will include Chuck Shelby, Mike Georgie, and Jackie Vakes, along with Jim Heminger. He's at Top Third Ag Markets in Chicago. Commodity Week, our weekly look at what's been happening in the world of agricultural commodities. Coming up next, have you finished up spraying your soybeans with Roundup or glyphosate? Have you looked yet to see whether you have any water hemp that's resistant? If you do, I've got a way to get a free test for confirmation of that fact. The weed scientists at the University of Illinois in Urbana suspect glyphosate-resistant biotypes of water hemp can be found throughout the state. Farmers just finishing up a round of spraying should know or at least be able to see if their fields might have a population of glyphosate-resistant water hemp shortly. It takes about 7 to 10 days for glyphosate to work, and if the water hemp is still green and growing, well, then it might be time to send a plant to the U of I for free herbicide resistance testing. Samples will be tested for resistance not only to glyphosate, but also to PPO and ALS inhibitors. The details for sampling are as follows. Select 5 water hemp survivors in the field. Remove the top inch or two containing young, newly emerged healthy leaves from each plant and seal inside a sandwich-sized Ziploc bag. Use a separate bag for each plant. Place those bags in an envelope and send them by overnight delivery to the U of I. Call your local extension office for the address. Ask them to look up Aaron Hager. Include your contact information, details about the herbicide history of the field and location of the field, GPS coordinates if possible. There's no promise here of a specific turnaround time because testing's free. In addition, due to the way in which the resistance tests are conducted, a test result of sensitive does not rule out the possibility that the plant actually is resistant, only that it's resistant by a mechanism different than what the test is looking to find. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. On this Friday afternoon, we're joined by Bruce Bostard. He's at the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois, to take a look at the cash grain market in that area. Good afternoon to you, Bruce.
Good afternoon.
How's basis holding up?
Not too badly, really, considering the bounce back that we've had in the board and the amount of grain that has been moving. We've seen the basis hang in there on corn.
Okay, Mike Zuzolo told us earlier in this program that that was the biggest two-day jump in the price of corn since 1988. I suspect that did push a lot of corn into the marketplace. Old and new crop both?
Old and new crop both. There's not as much old crop out there. The first day of the rally, we saw a lot of smaller lot buying evening up. We'd hit some offers that had come into the market trying to catch up, chasing the market down. The next day, it was a lot more larger lot selling and a lot more new crop.
Well, the fear always is that the cash market won't follow the futures higher. Were you taking protection each morning?
No, we weren't taking any protection out there. Didn't feel the need to do that on the rebound. I think one reason the basis is hanging in, there's a certain amount of reluctance maybe to move a whole lot of additional. People have kind of the train sold that they want to have sold or need to have sold out here, and there's going to be a certain amount of corn with some quality issues that's going to be carried over and blended off with new crop corn coming in.
And speaking of getting to the bottom of the bin, we're at the bottom of the bin for soybeans. How did they react as this week passed through?
Switched over to the Nove in general. We have a few places that went to the August. It's made for some really interesting basis trade because that July Nove, August Nove spread has been so volatile.
And what do you do about that? I mean, how do you trade it?
Put our hedges in the Nove, kind of put our head down and go. Hope not to get chopped up too badly.
I suppose there aren't any old crop beans left out there to really gather in, are there?
There's some, but not much. And it was people were kind of down to their last bullet, the gambling bushels, you know. So not a whole lot.
And what can they get for their Vegas round of beans today?
$9.46 on nearby beans as opposed to $8.69 on the new crop, so a good-sized inverse there.
And for your corn, your bids?
Corn, $3.49 nearby and $3.53 for new crop, so pretty flat on the corn.
Thanks so much, Bruce.
Thank you.
Bruce Bostard is with the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois, joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Friday afternoon, back in 2 minutes when we'll take a look at the agricultural weather forecast.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, General Motors Company says its first half sales of vehicles in China overtook the U.S. for the first time. The 1.21 million GM brand vehicles sold in China in January to June, a near 50% gain over a year earlier, compared with 1.07 million sold in the U.S. market. Meanwhile, U.S. auto sales slipped in June from the previous month, and major automakers said there was no sign of the second-half recovery the battered industry had expected at the start of the year. On an annualized basis, U.S. auto sales slipped to 11.08 million vehicles in June, down from 11.6 million vehicles in May. Apple says it is stunned to find that its latest iPhone model uses a completely wrong formula to show how many bars of signal strength it's getting. Apple says that's the reason users have been reporting big drops in signal strength when holding the phone in a way that blocks the antenna at the bottom of the phone. The company says that drop seems exaggerated because the phone wrongly displays 4 or 5 bars of signal strength when it should not. Apple says it will fix the formula. And Japanese electronics maker Toshiba Corporation today says it's jumping into the battery business for electronic vehicles in a development deal with Mitsubishi Motors Corporation. It's the first EV battery deal with a major automaker for Toshiba, which already makes batteries for laptops and cell phones. And that's a look at today's business news.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Friday afternoon. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason on the phone line with us. Jim Angel, state climatologist at the Illinois State Water Survey, located right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I. Thanks for being with us, Jim. We now have the month of June behind us, and it certainly was a wet one.
That's right. It comes as no surprise that June was very wet. In fact, it was the second wettest June on record for Illinois. We had 7.8 inches statewide average, and certainly there were some areas that are even wetter than that. Even here in Champaign County, we had some pretty wide ranges from about 8.3 inches at the water survey to 11 or 12 inches and to the east and west of us there. So very wet month. Also a very warm month as well. It's 10th warmest on record. The temperatures are running about 3 degrees above average.
When you see these types of variations and you get a month that's very wet and very warm for June, does it portend anything for the future?
Well, you know, I looked at past years where we had a wet June and just picked the top 10. And of those cases, 7 of the 10 had near normal precipitation in both July and August. So it does seem like whatever pattern was set up in June tends to kind of fall apart by the time you get into July. Certainly this week we've had an entirely different weather pattern, so we'll see how it shakes out here.
And the three outliers, were they normal years or drier than normal?
Well, one of them was 1993. In that case, the June wetness just continued on into July and August. The 2 years that turned dry after a wet June were 1945 and 1947.
Oh, well, we don't really remember what happened.
That's right. Yeah, that was way back.
Okay, so tell me about the forecast for the weekend.
Well, you know, it's a great weather for 4th of July. Temperatures over the weekend are being the upper 80s, maybe up to 90 degrees. Humid, but not as humid as it was 2 weeks ago. So I think see dew points more in the 50s and 60s. So it'll be pretty warm at night, or warm during the day, and a little cooler at night there. You do have a chance of rain on Monday and Tuesday as well. But otherwise, it looks like it's going to be a great 4th of July weekend.
Okay, and if you want to look a little further out and maybe do it as a climatologist and tell me what July would normally be like in Illinois.
Yeah, if you look at July in Illinois, typical is we get about 4 inches of rainfall over the month. Normal highs are in the mid to upper 80s, and normal lows are in the 60s. That's a pretty typical summer for us. Now, last year, of course, was the oddball case of very cold temperatures, but I think everything's pointing towards a closer to normal summer this year.
Jim, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Jim Angel, state climatologist at the Illinois State Water Survey, joining us here on a Friday afternoon during the Closing Market Report. If you can stay with us, please do for the farming world. If not, you can always hear it online at willag.org. That's willag.org. There you'll find the farming world and this program, the Closing Market Report, in their entirety. And it's all free at willag.org. You have a great afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
This is the Farming World News and interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we'll talk with Bruce Blanton. He's the Director of Transportation Services Division at USDA's Agricultural Marketing Service, and more importantly, the Project Manager for the 2010 Study of Rural Transportation Issues. It was released in April of this year. Mr. Blanton, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you.
It is a very comprehensive study, more than 600 pages, I think, if I rolled all the way down to the bottom of it, 607. Why don't you give me some of the key highlights to begin with?
Okay, I think I'll start, if it's okay, to basically let your listeners know kind of why the study came about. It was a study that was required by Congress in the 2008 Farm Bill. The Congress didn't ask us for recommendations, and we didn't provide any. But the approach of the report is to be educational, that is, to frame the issues for Congress and for stakeholders by providing information and background on the transportation issues that are important to agriculture. As you mentioned, the report is quite extensive. It includes 15 substantive chapters, and basically covers the four major modes of transportation that are used by agriculture in the United States, that is truck, barge, rail, and ocean vessels. The report covers the importance of freight transportation for the delivery of agricultural commodities, renewable fuels, coal for generation of electricity, as well as economic development in rural areas. The Congress also asked us to explore the sufficiency of rail transportation capacity, competition, reliability of service, reasonableness of rates, facility investment, and the rate grievance process for shippers. So as you indicated, it's quite comprehensive, and it's the first time that this kind of information has all been compiled in one spot.
Shall we start with rail?
Sure, or if you want, I could give you kind of a high-level overview of some of the major findings of the study, whatever your preference.
Well, let's go with the highlights, and then we'll come back to rail.
Okay, very well. The study found there was a decrease in the unrestricted interchange of rail traffic, a decrease in routing choices, and of competition. And this was due mainly to the rapid consolidation of railroads through mergers. We also found that rail shippers are very concerned about a number of issues such as switching limitations, restricted interchange, paper barriers, inconsistent service, high rates, excessive fuel surcharges, bottleneck rates, and the ineffective rate challenge process. We found that the limited antitrust exemptions that railroads and ocean carriers enjoy create a potential for decreased competition, poorer service, and higher rates. The study found there's a growing gap for the inland waterways and for the highways. We explored the agricultural exemption to the driver's hours of service rules and found that this exemption is very important to agriculture because of its unique needs during planting and harvest season.
This is for truckers now, right?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
This is for truckers. We also explored multimodally the different modes and found that we believe a more systems perspective is needed for the transportation network instead of the current approach, which is modal. In other words, funding highways separately than ocean or rail or barge. We believe those should be looked at from a more holistic system perspective. So in a nutshell, those were kind of some of the top line key findings of the study.
So in the holistic perspective, that would mean taking a look, for instance, at what the what the roadways look like going into the river terminals for a grain elevator, right? And whether there was a rail spur there as well, or and trying to divine which of those things needed to be updated, or if they all needed to be updated
and
simultaneously,
and how they compete and cooperate together to be a seamless network. Right now, the it's not like the system is bad; it does a good job. We've got one of the best transportation systems in the world, but it could use improvement. And what the point we're making is that when you're deciding what your infrastructure is, whether it be rail or highways or barges or ports, you should look at the entire picture from a systems perspective, not just make your decision on how you're going to fund the highways, divorced from what you're going to do with rail or what you're going to do with ports or what you're going to do with barges.
Let's take up rail in a bit more depth now. There was a large consolidation of the rail industry, and it happened fairly recently. What kind of impact does your study show that it has had?
Well, rail really is the only cost-effective mode of transportation to many agricultural producers. Rail competition is vital to agricultural shippers, since they don't have, since the railroads have certain exemptions from antitrust laws. We found that rail-to-rail competition for grain and oilseeds, for example, decreased between 1992 and 2007. And almost 75% of the agricultural areas lost rail competition over that period. Areas with a rail monopoly in transporting grain and oilseeds increased from 10 to 15%, and the revenue-to-variable-cost ratio increased in 83% of those agricultural areas. Rail rates for grain and oilseeds are higher than those for other commodities, and they have increased faster from 2003 to 2007. For example, grain and oilseed rates increased by 46% compared to 32% for all other commodities over the period. We found that during the 2001 to 2007 period, quarterly railroad fuel surcharges ranged from 55 to 137% higher than the incremental increase in the cost of fuel, which boosted railroad profits.
So railway is the one place that carries a whole lot of agricultural products, but here in the Midwest, where we have access to the river transportation system, the Illinois, the Ohio, and the Mississippi rivers, and the locks and dams, this is a place that handles, I think, something like 57%, the river transportation system as a whole, that is, of corn exported into the world market. Can you tell me what you found in the study about the river transportation system?
Sure, I'd be glad to do that. Barges move more than a third of our corn exports and over a sixth of our soybean exports to New Orleans to be shipped overseas. We found actually the modal share of barges has been slowly shrinking for a number of years, and the traffic on the waterways has declined. Although the aging, the locks and dams on the inland waterway system are generally reliable, but the repairs and maintenance have become more extensive and expensive with age. We also found that the Inland Waterways Trust Fund, which finances 50% of the capital cost of the inland waterways, has been declining since 2002. The lack of a clear path forward on funding, frankly, is of significant concern to farmers that depend on the waterways to move their crops to market. And the funding to maintain and rehabilitate the existing infrastructure needs to remain a priority.
Why has that allocation been going down since 2002? It surprises me because that's just a fund that's captured out of, or at least part of it that's captured from the private fleet, is a surtax on, it's a fuel charge.
And in simple strokes, it's the revenue coming in from fuel taxes has been declining, and the expenses have been going up. So, you know, over time, if you spend more than it's coming in, then the balance has declined.
What'd you find with the locks and dams themselves? Were there any things in the study that jump out at you? For instance, you always hear from the corn growers that the locks and dams simply aren't big enough, that a 600-foot lock isn't big enough to handle the size of tows that are running up and down the Illinois and Mississippi rivers at this point.
Yeah, that's clearly an issue that agricultural interests are concerned about. We found that the aging system, however, is generally reliable. But like I indicated earlier, the repairs and the maintenance become more extensive and therefore more expensive.
I understand that you can't make recommendations or weren't asked to make recommendations by Congress, and that they'll take up that issue separately.
Right. And what we were trying to do is provide background information so that we could educate them on the issues. It's really their job to take that information and do with it what they will.
Now, when you talk about the river system, we need to move into ocean freight as well. Because, of course, that's what the river system is in the United States is designed to handle, ocean freight, both coming into the United States and going out of the United States. What do you find with the ports and the ocean freights and the number of ships that are available?
Yeah, ports and ocean transportation are essential for agricultural exports. For example, in the past 5 years, over half our wheat, over a third of our soybeans, and over a sixth of our corn were exported. One of the things we found is more than half of U.S. agricultural exports by value, not by volume, but by value, move in marine shipping containers, and they include all types of agricultural products from bulk grains to frozen beef. The agricultural shippers that use containerized shipping are finding that containers and sufficient vessel capacity are one of the greatest challenges facing their business. And the recent decline in import cargo for consumer goods reduced the availability of containers for export cargo, and actually in some cases resulted in lost sales and unreliable service to overseas buyers. The infrastructure and technological improvements that are needed to expand capacity and to accommodate forecasted growth in U.S. trade and to avoid costly congestion at port.
I did make note that there were what I thought a very large number of ocean-going vessels, and that in the report it suggested, and while there are some times when there aren't enough available, that there were enough ships, generally speaking, available that And there was enough competition that they really did react to the marketplace. Did I read that correctly?
That's correct. Yes. Basically, the high shipping rates before the recession has slowed the scrapping of vessels and spurred building, but in moderated rates. But those companies have been responding to the current downturn by removing ships from the fleet or laying them up.
Now let's move to the last mode of transportation. That's the trucking industry. It is responsible, I suppose, for the bulk of movement of agricultural trade throughout the United States.
That's correct. In fact, trucks carry 70% of agricultural tonnage and normally include the first and the last movements in the supply chain. Trucking is highly competitive, and because of that, it keeps rates low.
Thank you so much, Mr. Blanton, for being with us today. We do appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking today here on The Farming World with Bruce Blanton. He is the Director of Transportation Services Division at USDA's Agricultural Marketing Service. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.
It's National Anise Day. The drink has its best popularity in France, Italy, Portugal, Mexico, and Spain. The sweet liquor is made by crushing 16 different seeds and plants and blending it with a neutral spirit and sugar syrup. On this day in agricultural history in 1869, the ship Novelty landed in Boston, Massachusetts. In its hold was more than 84,000 gallons of molasses, shipped on a new principle, not in casks, but in bulk in large tanks. In 1931, Stephen Babcock died, an American agricultural chemist. Babcock is often called the father of the scientific dairy industry. He developed a test to measure the fat content of milk, which helped improve the quality of commercial dairy production. It was the first time a standard for the fair payment of milk was established, and it aided in the production of cheese and butter. And in 1932, Dave Thomas, founder of Wendy's, was born. Perhaps one of Wendy's best advertising campaigns occurred in 1984, when Clara Peller looked into the TV lens and exclaimed, "Where's the beef?" The line was eventually used by Walter Mondale in a debate with Gary Hart in the Democratic primary election. And that's this day in agricultural history. Hi, this is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. Coming up next, you may have seen a backyard birdhouse or two in your time. Maybe you even own one. But the city of Urbana is taking this animal home idea one step further. Lisa Braltz has the story in her latest edition of In My Backyard.
Urbana residents Bonnie Fortune and Brett Bloom are artists and collaborators interested in fusing art, which they see mostly as asking questions rather than just creating works for eventual purchase by rock stars and corporate CEOs or museums. With sleeves-up, hands-dirty neighborhood projects that benefit not just the collaborators, but everyone in real time, whether they choose to participate or not. It's like using your neighborhood as a canvas in a laboratory, in a gallery, in a classroom. In 2006, Brett and Bonnie founded the Library of Radiant Optimism for Let's Remake the World. It's basically a library of books from the counterculture that came out in the late 60s and early 70s. They were written counter to stereotype by an incredibly productive group of people that felt that by dropping out and working on projects, like building bioshelters or generating their own power, growing their own food, things like that, they could literally remake the world. Brett and Bonnie started creating projects in the spirit of the books. Art and sculpture projects at first, but then they decided to create a community art space in their garage in East Urbana. The space hosted two events, both called Garage and Garden. Visitors could check out images of radical technology enlarged to poster size for better viewing on the garage's wall. Then they could leave the garage and see Brett and Bonnie's garden in action and share a meal with other folks. After two events, though, the two of them decided they'd outgrown the Garage and Garden concept and decided it would be more fun to work directly and collaboratively with their neighbors. They felt they could make change happen faster and more effectively by working with the neighborhood. So food-related projects, getting their hands dirty, became their new focus.
Well, the independent food culture here is so strong and so exciting. And the proximity to hardcore, like really committed, dedicated, awesome farmers, I mean, you can see them around town, is like, it's kind of a kick in the head after living in Chicago for so many years. And just to get to a farm, you have to drive a couple hours. I mean, it's really a detached thing. It's not immediate. I was involved with community gardens forever in Chicago, but coming here, there was really a direct connection. And we also had more access to land. So we had our own backyard. It was a perfect place to start experimenting.
Through Garage and Garden, they got people brainstorming, and that eventually spawned a bunch of neighborhood DIY or do-it-yourself projects. It really gave rise to the idea of place and awareness of environment. Everyone eats, and when you engage in a food project, you're really connected to where your food comes from. Brett and Bonnie really see the ideas of the late 60s and early 70s, stuff they were working on with the Library of Radiant Optimism, as gaining traction again today.
These patterns are repeating themselves, and a lot of people want a different system, a different holistic way of being in the world. And I think even something as small as making your own garden is a way to sort of try to step out of this culture, the destructive patterns of the culture that we live in.
This year, Brett and Bonnie had a chance to combine a neighborhood project with a full-on art project via a grant awarded by the City of Urbana's Public Arts Program. The project? Building 10 bat houses and locating most of them close to each other in Urbana in order to foster a large and very active bat population. That's right. I said bat population.
This project is called, very simply, Let's Remake Bat House. And then we came up with it this winter just thinking about local ecology and ecosystems and how wildlife and wild flora and fauna interact with the built urban environment. And we were thinking about creative ways to draw that relationship.
Bats are really beneficial to town dwellers and farmers alike. A small brown bat weighing half an ounce can eat 1,000 mosquitoes in an hour. A colony of 150 large brown bats can eat 33 million rootworms, which destroy corn, in a single season, along with thousands of cucumber beetles. Bat populations are in decline due in part to disease, but also because their habitat is being destroyed by various human activities. Bats are our buddies. They need places to live and reproduce safely.
If you drive around and look at a lot of farms, you'll see bat houses. Like, farmers understand, and for a long time have understood, the necessity of having bats around and the service they provide.
Brett and Bonnie's bat houses, which they build themselves with the occasional friend and neighbor, are called two-chamber rocket boxes. They look kind of like bottle rockets and are situated on top of 16-foot poles. They're painted a nice shade of sky blue to make them aesthetically pleasing, since many of the bat houses will visibly reside on private property. The idea here is form and function that gets people thinking and talking to each other.
About 3 years ago, when we moved here, we noticed this explosion in the use of rain barrels, this outward symbol that people cared about water conservation. So we're like, okay, what's the next step? Like, what other things? So we see this year an explosion of gardens just on our street alone, front yard gardens, people making gardens wherever there's sun in their yard to just raise that little or that much produce. Like, what other kinds of things? So when Bonnie and I were reading about bats and realizing in relationship to bats, like, how destructive the built environment is in a passive capacity without even considering their livelihood, their well-being, this is like an incredible metaphor, or a really sad metaphor, for just our general approach to thinking about our presence in relationship to one another, in relationship to the environment.
So the next time you happen to be outside at dusk, look up. Consider the bat. If we leave them alone and let them do their thing and maybe build them a few houses, it could be they'll help us out by keeping our neighborhood gardens healthy and our evenings in the backyard relatively mosquito-free.
Lisa Broth's stories can also be heard on our website, WILLAG.org. Click on the In My Backyard link in the right navigation window. And you can read her occasional blogs at majorprogression.wordpress.com.